Appreciate it. I know this has been a long day. My name is Dan Cohen. I'm with the Cohen Law Group, which is a law firm located in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We work on cable, telecom, and broadband issues. This session is called It Takes an E-Village, How to Build a Multi-Jurisdiction, Multi-Sector Approach to Broadband. But after hearing a number of the sessions today, this really seems like I don't know if it was intended to be, but really a culmination of the other sessions of the day. The focus is really on both the opportunities and the challenges of working collaboratively. I've heard every type of synonym for collaborative work this afternoon, whether it's peering or partnering or et cetera, but with other entities and other localities and building, operating, and sustaining a broadband network. That includes working with partners to build buying power and cost savings, as Joanne said during the E-rate session, aggregating local demand to pull in all community anchors, or working across private, nonprofit, and public sectors. We have a great group of speakers here to address really both the positive synergies available through a multifaceted approach to broadband, as well as some of the potential pitfalls. It may also be an opportunity to address the challenges and early lessons learned from the BTOP program. The architects of the projects that receive BTOP funding certainly hit the jackpot, but I think they're also finding that all that glitters is not gold as they wrestle with regulatory mandates and difficult deadlines. So, to address these and other issues, NATOA has assembled, I think, a really great panel of Lori Sherwood and Dan Gallagher and David Eisenberg. And I'm going to ask each of them to speak for 10 or 15 minutes. And I think we all agree what we really want is an active discussion during or after. Is it okay if it's during? I think it's okay if it's during. We like to have more of a dialogue and a monologue. But let me first introduce Lori. I don't have to introduce Lori. You all know who she is. She's on the board of directors of NATOA. But in case there are any of you who do not know her, she is with Howard County Government in Maryland. She's currently the broadband program director for the One Maryland ICBN Broadband Initiative. That's Inter-County Broadband Network, right? She co-directed the 18-month effort to obtain $115 million BTOP grant for the One Maryland Broadband Network. Lori will be managing the implementation of $72 million of federal BTOP funds that are directed to the 10 central Maryland jurisdictions that comprise that network. It will construct over 800 miles of fiber, and directly connect 715 community anchor institutions in the central Maryland region. Lori has over 15 years' experience in government affairs on the federal, state, and local levels, including extensive experience in strategic consulting, fundraising, et cetera. She's also a fellow lawyer. She graduated from American University and University of Baltimore School of Law, and that's as far as that goes, although it could go a lot longer. Lori, will you start us off, please?
Thank you, Dan, for that warm introduction. And it's always dangerous being the last presentation, the last panel of the day, because I'm very cognizant that we're the only thing keeping you all from happy hour. So we promise that we'd like to keep this lively and going and hopefully have a great discussion. So as Dan mentioned, I represent today the Inter-County Broadband Network, ICBN. It's the closest thing to intercontinental ballistic missile we could come up with at the time. So, but as Dan mentioned, as you know, we've gotten a grant. We're 10 members. And I think what's unique about our project is that we're the only project in the country that is completely comprised of owners that are all government, local government, city government, state government. And the governance structure is really represented by the IT personnel, the CIOs, or other staff on the project. And here's just a brief map of throughout the entire state. Of course, our project is just the Central Maryland portion, but it does connect the entire state. And then here, of course, is the Central Maryland jurisdictions that I represent. So one of the first things that we did when we were thinking about applying for this crazy BTOP money was we had to figure out what, at the end of the day, what we wanted to achieve. And one of the things that we wanted to do was interconnect all of the existing silo networks that were currently established in all the jurisdictions so that at the end of the day, we interconnected every county in the state. So you had a clear, you have a clear path, your will, throughout the entire county, and also to directly connect as many anchor institutions as we could. And so through our project statewide, that will be directly connecting 1,006 anchor institutions. Of course, the network will provide valuable cost savings and resources, and Ira talked a lot about that this morning in his presentation. Network capacity is a great thing. We are putting 216 cable count fiber in the backbone. It's all open access network, and it's going to provide us with a tremendous amount of resources for decades to come. So really the question we're here to address is, how do you build your own network in the post-BTOP era? With the likelihood that Congress won't be passing another American Reinvestment and Recovery Act anytime soon, we have to sort of band together to figure out what do we do next, capitalizing on what we've been able to do with the $4 billion that's been distributed across the country for broadband deployment, and where do we go from here? So for those interested in defining and building your own network, where do you start? One of the lessons that we've learned, I think, is that, and as Dan mentioned, we have to collaborate, because going it alone is not going to get you very far. So what you need to do is take a look at your goals, your purpose, your vision, your class of end users. What are you trying to accomplish? Who are you trying to reach? Identify all your possible stakeholders and partners, public and private. Look at the technology type that you want to deploy, wireless, wireline, satellite, combination. And that's critical. And BTOP was, we had to strictly define what type of technology that we were utilizing. And of course, our project is strictly fiber. But off of that, we will have wireless communications, we'll have microwave, we'll have all sorts of other capabilities. So even though the funding is strictly for fiber, it's really all-encompassing. And then, of course, one of the last most critical things is to identify all your funding sources, whether it's through bonds, private and public grants, capital projects, leveraging other private investments. And when you're looking at all of these together, really, you need to look at who your end users will be, your stakeholders, your partners, and how that will bring you funding mechanisms and resources that you can use to build your own network. Some of the key factors for success and the vision that you need to have is to develop a realistic budget and timeline. And I don't say use the BTOP one as an example. If it were up to me, there's no way I would build 1,200 miles of fiber in under 3 years on an artificial deadline. It's a construction project. What you're engaging in takes time. Some things you can fast track. Some things you should fast track. Others you need to be more accommodating of delays and things that are going to happen. Draw on existing relationships. And what I mean by that is we established a consortium in part out of a public safety working group, out of a cable administrator, Capitoa local group, and we put all of those existing relationships together to develop the consortium that we have today. And through that, we're able to leverage our existing public and private networks, and that has been critical to our success. Another thing is, Rick?
What kind of private networks will involve?
Well, there will be some hospital networks and some other things like that that come into play, sort of as offshoots. And for example, Johns Hopkins has a large network and a data center that we're going to be connecting to and things of that nature. And in fact, we're going to help them add to some of their locations through our network. The other thing that has been critical to our success is to engage the elected official community. Get the buy-in, not just from the end users and the groups that you're trying to reach with your network, but also to the local community so they understand what you're doing. Many of you already know the challenges you have when you're talking with some of your elected officials, notwithstanding those that are here today who really get it, but the ones out there who don't really understand the critical needs of infrastructure. And when they're looking at budgets and what to cut, IT, right? Well, what does that mean? What are you really cutting when you cut your IT budget? So the more you can engage your elected official community, the better off you'll be in particularly fostering one or two relationships of key people who can help you along the way. Allowing for an open access network. I can't stress this enough. Net neutrality, open access, these are things that we should be able to employ. It will be critical for sustainability, innovation, economic development. So what are some of the things that you may encounter? Some of the things that we've learned is that you will encounter permitting problems and misutility problems and locate problems. And you will get calls from local utilities saying, hey, is there any money in your budget to reimburse me for my locate costs? And then your response is, did you do that for the other cable providers when they were building their networks? No, okay, thank you. We just thought we'd ask. Pole attachment agreements. I know Jim and Casey know full well that as a local government, it doesn't necessarily guarantee you access rights to poles. And sometimes negotiating these pole agreements can be almost as difficult as anything you'll encounter. Once you have those set, then you're going to encounter more delays and costs and overruns and make-ready costs and things. One of the biggest things I can't stress enough, and no, I don't want to, you know, denigrate the lawyers in the room, but to say that anticipate delays with legal reviews. Some of our most difficult challenges have been working with lawyers who don't understand technology but need to review contracts. And in fact, one of the lawyers that we encountered who had a conversation with us about pole attachment agreements in particular was saying, well, how do we know in 5 years that this technology won't be outmoded and then it'll all come down? You're saying, well, guarantee you in 5 years we will not be pulling fiber off of poles. This is here for the long haul. What we're doing is a long-term plan, not a short-term one. And then, again, fostering the relationships with key elected officials who can assist with permitting, with agencies, putting pressure on companies that you need assistance with in a behind-the-scenes kind of way. And also, just every day come to work prepared that something is going to happen that you didn't anticipate. Be ready to problem solve. Be ready to spend most of your time solving problems. And again, if I didn't mention it, anticipate delay with legal review. So some of the successes that we've had, I think, can really goes to why collaborate, why be partners. And we looked around the region, and everyone has a procurement nightmare, how long it takes to get a contract review, dealing with purchasing. So we sat down with the purchasing office in Howard County, who was doing the procurement on behalf of the entire region. We worked out a process. And within 8 months, we completed 6 very complicated procurements. For construction, for engineering, for fiber, for logistics and staging, all sorts of things. And because we were pooling our resources and we were very carefully constructed our RFPs, we got excellent pricing that allowed us to put things under budget. We built in cost savings for the life of the contract and the term of the grant. We hosted vendor fairs to generate interest in the vendor community to get their buy-in, and so that we could communicate with folks all together and, where need be, match subs and prime contractors. One of the other things that we did that was widely successful, I think, was we heard from the small and minority business community that they really wanted to be a part of this. They really wanted to be getting prime contract awards, but because of their size, they couldn't necessarily meet the bonding requirements or the insurance needs, but they really wanted to participate in an active way. So what we did was we created an application form, very simple, really, that states whether you're a small or minority business, your certification, how many years you've been in this business, what exactly you've been doing, and we vetted them, and we put them on a list. And then we built into our construction RFPs incentives for the primes to select the small minority businesses that were on our preferred vendor list. And I think we have over 60 small and minority businesses right now on our vendor list. The other thing that has been, well, I guess Mitzi you would say is a success, is engaging in group negotiations for MOUs and other agreements on a group level. It's complicated when you're working with all the different jurisdictions, but at the same time, it provides a great deal of benefit to have a neighbor and a colleague in another jurisdiction stand with you and say, no, we need to do this because of this. And it's not just one person standing up saying, we need to get something moved past. And one of the last things that I wanted to mention was that, more importantly, you need to realize limitations. What is it you're trying to achieve? What realistically you can do? Goals that you need to meet? And what should be taken off-site, out of the government realm? And so, as Ira mentioned this morning, we've created the Center for Broadband Innovation to help assist us with a lot of the services and application development to really be a do tank for the community in achieving what, as government, is not our core competency. And so we're going to be, through the Center for Broadband Innovation, where we're going to have people who can spend all of their time focused on targeted initiatives, seeking grant funds, and developing a public sector cloud application store for services that will go on the network. And what we found is that as it's governments, we're very busy with the mundane things, the implementation, if it's mundane, the implementation, the construction, the engineering, the procurement. But really, it takes a nonprofit or another organization who can spend 100% of their time focused on building the partnerships and building off of the consortium to make the network really robust. So finally, I would say just think outside the box. There is no one-size-fits-all model. What works in Maryland may not work in North Carolina, as we know, or may not work in Illinois. But take the lessons of what all of us have been doing around the country and see what works for you. Be creative, collaborate, communicate, and most of all, enjoy what you do.
That was great. Very, very informative. Thanks, Lori.
There are questions.
I have a quick question.
Yes, please.
Are you using the right-of-way of all the participants? How are you dealing with right-of-way?
Yes, absolutely. We're. It was dealing with the right-of-way. Are we using existing rights-of-way? We are. For the jurisdictions where the county rights-of-way are involved, it's very simple because the counties are owning their own infrastructure, so that's great. But we are using state rights-of-way and are on other private roads, perhaps in a few instances of it. So,
great. Let's move to our next speaker. Our next speaker is, I think, trying to achieve the same result, which is high-value, low-cost community broadband, but from a very different perspective. And I'm also not going to question anything he does because he's a former commander in the United States Navy. He'll throw me in the brig or something if I object. Dan Gallagher is Chief Executive Officer of the Open Cape Corporation. He served as volunteer president and chairman of that corporation for 4 years before resigning those positions and becoming full-time CEO in 2010. As I mentioned, Dan is a former naval officer, retired at the rank of commander in 1999 after a distinguished career in naval intelligence. Following retirement, he became the technology manager of the Dover-Sherborne and Dover-Sherborne regional school districts. He joined Cape Cod Community College as the Executive Director of Information Technology in 2005. He has his BS from Boston State College and the MS from the Defense Intelligence College. How many of you can say that? He also attended Middlebury College Mandarin Language School, so obviously somebody that is a Renaissance man. Dan, would you please take over?
Thank you. I'm not going to do a lot of slides here, but I wanted to give you some familiarity with our project, if you haven't heard. One of the things that you do need is leadership about any of these projects. And early on, it's hard to get that developed, and so I had to play that role. And unfortunately, most of the people that have been involved with me in this project call me the benevolent dictator. Now, you need a benevolent dictator in some instances, especially to get these things going. You need someone who's going to stand up and wave the flag and say, come follow me, we can do this, let's do it together. In 2005, I joined Cape Cod Community College as the IT director. It's about 5,000 students on Cape Cod. And I had never worked or lived on Cape Cod, and I was shocked to find out that we had three T1 lines for $45,000 a year for 5,000 students. Absolutely absurd that you could even deliver the services that you needed, and at that cost, I couldn't believe it. So that was 2005. I went to the incumbent providers. Comcast has a presence on Cape Cod. Verizon has a presence on Cape Cod. And I asked them, you know, what I needed. I said, can you deliver this? And both of them said, no, we don't need to, and we're not going to, basically. So I asked, along with some other folks I met who had a similar problem at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and a couple other places, we all started to talk about this. We said, the only way we're going to fix this is to fix it ourselves. So we put out a notice, if you're interested in this topic, if this is a problem for you and you want to do something about it, come to Cape Cod Community College and talk about it. That was in 2006. 100 people showed up from business and government and education, and we told them immediately, if you're here to complain, you're in the wrong building. If you're here to do something about this, you're with the right people. So we formed a steering committee, 2006, started this process, formed a nonprofit company eventually, to where we are now as Open Cape Corporation. And I will mention on the good part of lawyers, I was very fortunate to have a nice guy named Pat Butler, unfortunately he's passed away, who saw what we were doing and said, this is a great, great idea and I want to help you pro bono. Until someday you'll make some money and you can pay me at that point. But he had a big law firm in Boston that had all the resources I needed, whether it was for a trademark, 501c3, telecommunications law, contract law. They could call on anybody, and it was an essential resource. And if you can get a law firm that understands that their future is dependent on a good future economically in your region, it's a very good resource to have. Here's the basic descriptions. We're a nonprofit 501c3. Our charitable purpose is to reduce the burden of government with the IRS. We have a representative board. That's a legitimate 501c3 status, by the way, for charitable purpose. The concept is to develop an infrastructure of the 21st century in telecommunications. And one thing I'm constantly telling people, this is an underpinning technology. It is infrastructure, no different than roads, no different than water mains. It's not the solution. It's enabling technology. We have a $40 million project. You can see the listed funding sources there. We have a $32 million broadband grant. And the bottom line system is about 300 miles of backbone middle mile, 50 miles of laterals, a microwave public safety overlay, largely because we worry so much about hurricanes, and that's the most easily restored. If you read anything about Katrina, you'll know this is the right thing to do. And we also have a regional co-location center that sort of collectively aggregates all that stuff together, all the fibers terminating there. This is what it looks like on Cape Cod, but also to southeast Massachusetts. We needed to get to through hearing points where we could actually connect to other folks, right? Critical element, I agree completely. So we go to Providence, which brings us further down to New York, and to Brockton, which takes us to 1 Summer Street in Boston, and the major peering point for New England. The green is the microwave overlay. We couldn't get to Cape Cod with the fiber because the environmental permits would be so great, we'd never get it done in time under the NTIA's program. And we're going to lease fiber on a power line out to Nantucket Island. And that big bullseye is where the co-location center is. We're a little bit different from a lot of the government programs that are really just focused on the anchor institutions. We're not a state government. We're a private company. We're not a university. A lot of the BTOP grants were to universities. The primary reason we got involved in this was economic development, actually. Everybody on Cape Cod, and this is where, you know, a crisis, a problem can become the opportunity. We all realize on Cape Cod we have a serious economic problem. We have an unsustainable economy in the long term. We're too reliant on hospitality and tourism, and retirees, and partial year residents. And the young people are fleeing with their children out of our area because there's not the opportunity for them to live there year round. We need to diversify and expand our year round economy, and this is how we plan to do it. Another benefit to that are all the public things that can happen and be efficient, made more efficient. So here's some of the economic benefits to us. Your calls are dropped on the cell phone because there's no backhaul from the tower. We're gonna fix that. We have an agreement with NSTAR to integrate smart grid into this. We're giving them 12 strands of fiber in order to get access to the power space on the pole. We routed to all the fiber, the technology parks, shopping centers, commercial government centers. Made the path go by there in order to reduce that lateral length that needs to be built to keep the costs as low as possible. We envision last mile providers coming in. Speaking with a lot of folks yesterday, one of my biggest concerns is that if you're going to do this in a big way, if you're going to do fiber to the home, I think we need to have a municipal program. That's probably our next step. I don't want to say that, but that's probably what our next step would be. The dark and high capacity, so we have a very unique arrangement. We are a public-private partnership. We are the grant recipient as the nonprofit. We represent the interests of the community, and we have licensed a private company to operate our 60% of our network on our behalf. So it's a little bit different. We're solving a lot of the problems for the larger institutions like the community college, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, with high, and also the military base that's on Cape Cod, had a long-standing problem. The regional co-location center is an aggregation point for leased rack space for both businesses and for government entities. Here's some of the regional government services. We call this regional umbrella services because if you're from New England or any place that has towns instead of counties, it's very, parochial people, I guess we could call ourselves up there in New England. But you can't talk about combining towns. Even though there's only 1,200 people in the town, they're just not going to do it. But they don't have the size to do anything, frankly. They can't even keep the computers running, right? So I only talk about regional umbrella services. I'm not going to merge anybody. But there's common services that you all have. And the reason we're going to address that is we create a regional area network for all of them. It's 10 gig rings, basically. To each of about 70 points that will connect a gig circuit into those locations, where they can now aggregate their needs. We provide them with a gigabit shared commodity internet for them to share and Internet 2 access on that same ring, and they can do common applications in that co-location center, and we're going to buy the first VM hardware structure for them to do it. You can see the applications down here, regional GIS, e-permitting and licensing, assessor databases, a data warehouse. School districts, before I left the college, I converted them from Blackboard, proprietary, very expensive learning management system, over to Moodle so that all the K-12 and the community college could share the same application, gain all those efficiencies. The water districts are involved by providing us access to their water towers, and we're doing a lot for public safety. The Executive Office of Public Safety in the state see just connecting to one point to connect to every police station throughout our whole region. We're building a 700 megahertz mobile public safety system as well. And all the shelters get connected as well over this. So you can see we're having the municipal regional area network now is the underlying physical structure where all of this stuff connects and works. The funding, Open Cape's all the capital costs. The big thing is gets down to operating costs. There is a fee with this. I wanted to give it to them for free, but the BTOP people wouldn't let me do it. They said, no, you have to charge them something because they weren't sure about my sustaining business model. But we will give it to them free eventually. We'll give it back to them on the back end. So you have to have some way to do that, and you have to have a governance structure for how I don't want to make, as Open Cape, the municipal RAND decisions. What's the next application to come on? What's the priorities? I want the towns and the school districts and the libraries and the police departments to make that decision. We want to be maybe a seat at the table of that body, but we don't want to make those decisions. We want them to make those decisions. So a couple of unique things about us is the business model. We're a nonprofit private company. We're doing commercial and public activities. The commercial side is going to pay for eventually and reduce to zero, in my estimation, in a very short order, the cost to the public side for all of these services. And the bigger issue, and I think this is really what we're here to talk about, and I don't want to, this is my last slide here, is we have Smarter Cape, which is the bigger picture. You know, these things are all four phases. What do we want to do? How do we get the money to do it? How do we build it? Which is where I am now, right? What we're more and more focused on is what are we going to do with it once it's built? And so we've created Smarter Cape, which is a partnership. We're trademarking Smarter Cape and all those things that you need to do. But we've included the Chamber of Commerce for the region, the Technology Council, the Cape Cod Commission, which is the regulatory body within our region, the Economic Development Commission for the region. All of us meet weekly to work out the details of what we're going to do with this. What do we see as our vision of 10 years from now for Cape Cod in all these different spectrum, healthcare, education, public safety? How are we going to get there? And we even have a meeting on the 27th. David and I are going to a visioning session. 50 of the leaders of our community are going to be there to talk about this future and how we're going to get there. Because this is the real challenge, and these are some of the points that were being made here by Laurie, is how do you bring all these people together? You have to have a real plan for that, and in our case, I mean, I have a quarterly newsletter to all the politicians and all the 700 people who follow us on our website, right? I have a legislative breakfast every half a year, and we give them breakfast and thank them profusely for all their help and all those things. I've been out in the past 4 months I've visited each town at least 3 times and many 5 times to speak with IT directors, economic development committees, planning committees, boards of selectmen. You have to get out there and collaborate and communicate with these folks. We have a formal committee of all the chiefs of police and fire department combined who work on this public safety issue. Again, the 700 megahertz system, I don't want to own that. They're making a body, they're creating a body to administer that and make decisions about it. So it's key that you do those things and you communicate regularly with people in order to make these things happen. So that's my points.
Wow.
Thank you very much. When you're talking about, you know, meeting with all the local groups and the parochialism as well as some of the towns there, you know, the variation of a former Speaker of the House from Massachusetts kept coming into my head saying, all broadband is local, all broadband is local. It requires a tremendous amount of energy, that's for sure. Our final speaker this afternoon is David Eisenberg, and let me kind of shorten your bio a little bit. David is a fellow at GLOCOM, the Institute for Global Communications of the International University of Japan. He's a founding advisor of the World Technology Network. In his 12-year career at AT&T, David was a distinguished member of the technical staff with AT&T Labs Research, the part of Bell Labs that stayed with AT&T after the 1996 divestiture, or as David says, trivestiture. Before that, he held AT&T Bell Labs technical positions in consumer long distance networks and network services. Before AT&T, he was employed by Mattel and Verbex and did consulting work in voice processing for Milton Bradley and GTE Labs and others. David also is just coming off of organizing his own separate conference here in San Francisco yesterday called Net Workshop. And that was a workshop for network practitioners. I'm gathering you're probably a little bit tired, but and when I talked to David over the phone before this session, he said, well, I won't really have a formal presentation. I really want to comment on the others. So you have the floor.
Thanks. Well, music is the original communications technology. How many people here are familiar with the great guitar player John Fahey? There's a few people. Okay, so I have a friend who was probably the greatest guitar player nobody ever heard of. His name was Perry Letterman. He's gone now. But Perry told a story about how one day John Fahey was playing a gig in Greenwich Village in the 60s or the early 70s, and Perry came into the back room, back of the room, and sat down, and John Fahey stopped in the middle of the song and put his guitar down and said, I can't play with someone like that in the room. So that's kind of how I feel. You guys are my heroes. Dan Gallagher, every time I turn around, he's doing something new and brilliant and amazing. One thing he didn't tell you is that part of Cape Cod's economy is that, tell me if I'm wrong, 15,000 cars a day, every weekday, go over the two bridges that we have to commute to Boston. Says, with Open Cape and Smarter Cape, we can bring the work to the people. The people don't have to go to the work anymore. So, and Dan's been just instrumental in understanding that that the technology is just the start. It's the infrastructure on which we build community. And Dan's been catalyzing these efforts with the police chiefs and the fire chiefs and the and the Cape Cod Technology Council and the selectmen and the chambers of commerce of the various towns and so on. And I've seen it up close. I live part-time on Cape Cod, and I grew up on Cape Cod. It's really my home. And so I've seen Dan and his chairman of the board, Art Gaylord, from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. I've seen this up close. I've seen these guys develop this concept from where it was first just a wireless ring to fiber optic with wireless, and then fiber optic with wireless with community and economics and applications and broad and growing interest, and it's just amazing. So, and I know each of you are doing similar things in your community, and I encourage you to think way beyond the technology, to think about, you know, here we have freedom of speech that is scalable. We have the ability for everyone to own a printing press and a television station and to broadcast and to make their points of view known. And we have to keep the internet open and free so we can keep doing that. And we have to provide more and more bandwidth so that when the sexy new high bandwidth applications come, that every one of us, every citizen, has access to that. So I, you know, we're down in the often, you know, talking about the ins and outs of the E-Rate and the Universal Service Fund and our little particular city problems. But let's not lose sight of the bigger picture that we're really talking, you know, one of the things that Dan said, I heard in Lafayette, Louisiana, the network, the fiber to the home network in Lafayette, Louisiana, is so the kids will come home. They won't have to leave town to get a job. Same on Cape Cod. You know, the population is getting old and gray. I'm a young guy for Cape Cod, you know. we're talking about the fundamental human existence in the 21st century. We have huge problems to solve, the environment, the economy, being a citizen in a world of 7 billion citizens. Broadband can help. Let's not lose sight of the bigger picture. So, that's really all I want to say, other than thanks to Joanne. I knew this is the fact that I'm speaking here. I'm just a schlepper compared to you who are building the networks, doing the work, organizing your communities. And Joanne just let me speak so I could come to the meeting for free. So thank you, Joanne. It was a hack. But we appreciate good hacks, right? So I'm not going to stand between us and happy hour. I think you should ask Dan and Lori questions if you have them. And thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, David. Is he getting in for free today, by the way? Please.
David is too modest. also does not sufficiently recognize his own role in motivating and catalyzing and stimulating people to do this incredibly important work. And that's a pretty important role.
That's true. Thank you, but you guys are doing it, so my hat is off to you.
I agree. Thanks very much for your perspective, David, and what everybody's doing. But he was able to articulate it in a lofty way, which I certainly appreciate. Yes.
There was no formal contest from them, but I think there might have been some informal behind-the-scenes activity that went on, but not significant. I've made a real effort to keep them informed and keep them engaged so that I cannot be accused of not including them. I want our community to have as many options as they possibly can in a competitive marketplace for the foreseeable future. Those incumbents are part of that. So we send them the RFPs directly and say, do you want to bid on this? Our fiber structure is open access so that if they can't reach, which they can't in some cases, the outer Cape communities, or they're not willing to invest the capital, they can lease dark fiber from us to help improve their services to their customers.
Do you have any interest in that?
Not yet, but I think it's a possibility. The other thing is, I think that, and I don't want to speak for specific incumbents, but in some cases I think their interest is not there. They just say, well, it's going to wither on the vine. And, when Verizon, for example, sold New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont to Fairpoint, if they didn't have the Boston market, they probably would have sold Massachusetts. Because on Cape Cod, we're not seeing an improvement of the capital plant. They acknowledge that. When I worked at Cape Cod Community College, for example, I couldn't put an E911 because we didn't have PRI service at the central offices. I had to do a workaround with 1,000 DIDs to route it to another central office. And there was no indication that that was going to be improved. I understand all that. That's why I say our destiny is in our own hands. We can't look to others to do it. We need to take care of it ourselves.
I was just going to ask Lori if she could address that as well. Has there been pushback from the industry with respect to One Maryland?
There were no, like Dan was saying, we also had no formal challenges. We've had many communications and conversations with providers. We're working with several of them on our pole attachments. We're doing ride-outs weekly. They're reluctantly cooperating, but doing a good job. I mean, we're working well together. We've also had multiple conversations with providers for dark fiber leasing, and we have several that I believe as soon as the network is available and put in that they will be leasing from us. Including a wireless carrier, Freedom Wireless, TW Telecom has expressed interest. Level 3 has spoken with us. So there's a lot of interest. Whether at the end of the day it translates into anything, I'm not exactly sure yet. But we've had a lot of communications, and so far it's been a pretty good experience with the incumbents.
And I would say also on that same question that since we've really become, I think folks at certain times thought they'll never get this done. This is just a bunch of yahoos trying to work this out, and it's never going to happen. Now that it is going to happen, some of the very services that I requested from my college that I couldn't get are now available on Cape Cod at very low prices with a 5-year contract. Right.
David, did you want to speak as well?
Yes. So to your point, one of my friends, Anders Comstedt, built the STOCAB network in Stockholm, which was the first municipal dark fiber network that anybody I know knows about in the mid-90s, 94, 5, 6 in there. And Telia, the incumbent, the former PTT, was the biggest opponent. They screamed and yelled all the way to the, to whatever governing bodies they could. But then once the network was built, Telia became a big supporter and their biggest customer.
And just one more quick thing to add, I'm sorry, that one of the providers, our local Broadstripe is a cable company, a small one in Maryland. They were named in our application to be a last mile provider, and they followed through on that commitment. And we are building laying fiber in southeastern Anne Arundel County for an 800 home community that has no service whatsoever.
Yes, sir.
Lori and Dan, both of your organizations kind of formed a separate group, whether it was Smarter Cape or the Center for Innovation. How did you handle that financially? Is the VTOP money going to those organizations, or is that different sources of funds that are making that happen?
Well, in our case, our activities are being funded by sponsors when we hold events, largely. So, for example, we held a Smarter Cape Summit in May. Very successful event. It was sponsored. And we deliberately hoped to get, and we did get, over a subscription on the sponsorship that carries us through to hold other events. Or, for example, we're having an event on the 27th with 50 people. The local hospital, as part of the, we call it the Healthcare Vertical Advisory Committee, is going to sponsor us and provide the lunch and that sort of thing. So there's not a lot of expense to that kind of thing. It's just making sure people show up.
And, yes. Sorry, Laura.
That's okay. Ours does not have any, no BTOP funding is going to the Center for Broadband Innovation. It's a separately funded organization that has just come out of the need for services to be on the network and things. It's separate from the actual infrastructure network.
We've talked today mostly about broadband to institutions. The conference title is Gigabit Communities. And I'm wondering whether anyone would like to comment on how these broadband to institution connections could be drivers for broadband to everyone, to the residences, or to enhance business development, that is broadband to businesses.
The dark fiber that we're making available to lease, for example, TW Telecom is interested in building off of our backbone into business parks and commercial areas. They do not provide residential services, but other companies are planning on or would like to do that also. But you're absolutely right. There's also an opportunity to put wireless communications into schools, utilizing the gig that's going into the schools and be able to push out microwave or other technologies in the surrounding areas. We're looking at pilot projects to do that. In fact, the one of the things that the Center for Broadband Innovation is going to be doing is working on a fiber project, two of them, sister projects, one in a public housing complex that's providing gig service to 300 homes. And then the second one is going to be studied simultaneously, which is a wireless project, part of the Morgan State University, Morgan Mile, where they're pushing service out to a mile radius around the campus and introducing services and technologies to people and looking at what people do with wireless versus wireline technology, what types of applications that they enjoy and look at. So there's a lot of potential for all different types of applications, whether it's Broadstripe going into these 800 homes or something a little more targeted.
So in our case, we're obviously designing our network to be a commercial network to begin with. But in the anchor institution cases where we go to a lot, we have about 30 libraries, a dozen schools that are also shelters, and about 20 town halls or police stations that represent the hubs of the communities. So we looked at each one of those laterals to those if they were off the main fiber pathway, and we said, okay, what is the potential for growth on that lateral? So if it might be a tiny library, but we ran 48 strands out there. Someone would say, why are you running 48 strands? This is a library. Well, because we see the potential for a future growth to an industrial park that's another couple of miles down the road. So if those customers appear, there's available fiber. We have splice points every quarter mile on average so that you can easily expand the network.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and the co-location center works the same way, that it's available for both commercial activity and for the public entities. We reserve public space there for them at no cost for the government side, and we're going to provide the first hardware that they use for the common applications there.
Yes, sir.
Yes, speaking of fiber, it's my understanding that there's at least a five-month wait now, or will be very soon, in obtaining fiber for construction. Have you experienced any of that at all?
So in my case, Corning, for example, is accepting no orders. This is a mixture of things. It's partially the tsunami. The production activity that Japan was previously providing is not there, and their demand for fiber has gone up dramatically to repair what was damaged. So you go down to a fewer number of companies that are offering the fiber. Some BTOP recipients, actually, my understanding is that they actually had their orders in with Corning and they were not honored, or they had quotes that were not honored, I guess is the case. In our case, we were lucky. We've had a long conversation through our private contractor with the fiber providers, and in our case, we went Draka. And so the conversation had been going on for some time, and we got a guaranteed 8-week delivery. We've already had our first delivery, and every month we get another 35 miles over the next 10 months. So we're pretty lucky in that respect.
And fiber was our very first procurement that we did because it was the most important asset that we needed to procure. We were lucky in that we completed most of the contract negotiations prior to the tsunami occurring in Japan, and we locked in with OFS, who's our prime supplier, for a guaranteed amount of fiber, and they're delivering it to us 50 miles per month every month, standard. And they have been a great partner to us. But we were a little bit lucky with the timing, because had we done the procurement a month later, we wouldn't have gotten the prices that we did, and so we were able to lock in for the till the end of the grant the same price.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about two questions back about the gigabit communities and actually getting that last mile infrastructure. And in our case, we're looking at a pilot project to 500 homes with fiber. A huge factor in the decision to do that was the fact that Clackamas County received the grant that Jeremy was talking about earlier to do the middle mile project. And I know Joanne hit on this earlier, but without we're basically going to get free dark fiber because we're trading them some of our city resources for that ring to come through. But without that piece, you know, being able to provide a gig to a neighborhood wouldn't be possible at the prices that we're trying to hit. So I would hope that as these middle mile projects get built out, and both of yours included, that, you know, that would become available for more communities. So
absolutely. In our case, and you know, in New England, I can't speak to the rest of the region, but for example, next week I'm going to a meeting among all the New England BTOP recipients. So we have a grant down in Southeast Massachusetts. There's another organization, Ocean, in Rhode Island. Western Massachusetts is a grant. There's one in Vermont, New York. And we all talk once a month on the phone. How are we going to connect all of our networks for the betterment of the overall community? So we can create a huge middle-mile backbone that connects all of these areas together. To provide all that access to those pairing points and other things that you want to gain access to at very low cost.
And Ditto, we don't have the conversation with some of the local projects like Dan has in New England. I'm from New England, so I know how we all like to stick together, those of us north of New York. But we're also having those conversations on a national level with US Ignite and through GigU, and some of the conversations and connecting the Genie networks. And really the primary focus is how can we interconnect those across the country, leverage what we have, and be able to push it out to more communities. And I think the bottom line is that there's no one group or network or a provider that can do it alone, and that really it's going to take both private and public sector and higher education pulling together to really get where we need to be for the global economy.
And if I could just make one other last comment, you know, I think this is sort of for you, Joanne, and others. There was a comment made about TechNet this morning, for example, creating a warehouse of information. And, you know, as we talked a lot yesterday at David's conference about how do we get this to really bloom nationwide, right? I mean, it's about money and other things, but how can you make that happen at reasonable costs to the community? And I think a couple of things that I'd love to see. One, a library of examples of these projects, some in big county areas, some in small town, some rural, some urban, that people can who want to do this and aren't going to get the grant that I was given can advance this across the nation as an effort. I think there are things that people can do to make this more likely to happen in their communities through, I think, things like regulatory reform to get control over pole access, to drop the cost by probably half of a project, regulatory environments within your community, aiding in getting these kinds of projects rather than being an obstacle to them. There's a lot of things that could be done to help advance this across the nation. And I know I can tell you, if you go to my website, every RFP will be there, every respondent's name, you're welcome to copy. If you want a contract of any contract that we've drawn to make it easier for you to get a sense of, for example, the fiber breakdown, how I control the private operator, I would be glad to send it to you. We have to have more, you know, to get this advancing into a bigger scenario across the country. And one point thing is, and Notoa's got my email account,
wrong on the handout, so that won't work if you send it to me.
May I add, in terms of regulatory reform, those states in which public broadband networks are prohibited, like North Carolina, like Pennsylvania, or severely restricted, in Pennsylvania, let's say conditionally prohibited, and that's a key regulatory reform that has to take place as well.
Create a nonprofit.
Absolutely. And our firm is regulatory counsel to a higher ed network, which really is a nonprofit network, 1,600 mile. But it would be great if in those states where political subdivisions are prohibited from putting together these networks, that prohibition's got to be overturned. It has to be. I had a bunch of questions, but I'm not going to ask them because we're past our time. I'll ask them privately. I thought this was a great session. I thought it was a great day, and thank you all for being so participatory in this session. And thank you so much to the panelists for enlightening us.